Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and this is the Friday Roundtable. Today, the frontiers of fertility. Where's the invention and innovation headed for assisted reproduction? How good is the support system for couples or individuals who are struggling with having biological children? What is it that scientists still don't know about fertility? Three guests and a wide-ranging discussion today, and I hope you'll join in. If you're using fertility treatments to have children, what do you know now that you wished you'd understood at the beginning? Have you gotten the kind of emotional support that you need? So think about that as we begin our discussion, and I hope you'll weigh in on Twitter. It's at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I, M-P-R. Our roundtablers today, Elise Ash is the founder of Fruitful, a nonprofit fertility mentorship project. Welcome. Good to have you here, Elise.
Hi.
Linda Hammer Burns is with us, a licensed psychologist and associate professor at the University of Minnesota Medical School. Welcome. Good to have you here, Linda.
Thank you.
And Dr. Elizabeth Stewart is the chair of the Division of Reproductive Endocrinology and Infertility at the Mayo Clinic. Elizabeth, welcome. First name's okay with you.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for coming up from the Mayo, too. I know that's a bit of a drive, and I really appreciate it. And Elizabeth, I'll start with you on this. I read a study abstract ahead of the conversation that said that for couples who are planning on being parents, a diagnosis of infertility can be as devastating as a diagnosis of cancer, that it is that transformational as an individual or as a couple.
Absolutely. I think infertility is a disease, and that isn't widely recognized.
I didn't know that.
It's defined by all of the major medical organizations as a disease, and I think any disease impacts your life. So if you have cancer, you have medical appointments, you have invasive procedures. But if you think about it, infertility goes even further than that. Not only do you have appointments and prescriptions and medications, but it really interferes with your daily functioning, the functioning of your relationship. Some couples become so overwhelmed with the process of infertility, they don't even try naturally. It interferes with their relationship, with their sex life. It's a huge impact for most people.
Linda, you nodded when you heard that. You've heard that before.
Yeah, there's been a lot of studies on that, both in the U.S. and especially a consortium of mental health professionals in Scandinavia and the U.K. That shows that it's comparable as cancer. It's also comparable in that with cancer, you don't know what the outcome will be.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes it stressful. People don't deal well with ambiguity. And that's the same thing with infertility. We're going through all of this, but what will be the outcome? And, you know, I've had patients say to me, I can't live if this doesn't work.
Do you think this is about, because I know you've been through this, is it also about a sense of identity? This was key to who I think I'm going to be in the world. And if this is not fulfilled, a part of me isn't going to be fulfilled.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's part of the trauma initially of even getting that infertility diagnosis. We're taught at such a young age that getting pregnant is really easy. You could just look at a boy in seventh grade and get pregnant. And then all of a sudden, when you're 32 and that's what you really want and you found a partner and you're ready, and then all of a sudden it doesn't happen the way that you thought it was going to happen, it's really easy to feel like a failure. You feel like your body's failing you, like you haven't emotionally even accounted for this outcome. And then all of a sudden you're faced with a huge decision that is usually really expensive, stressful. You probably don't understand the biological implications of what's going on anyway. So there's a lot of research. It's just, it's a lot to process and come to terms with.
Your own story is In 2014, you decided that you would start trying to have a baby.
Yeah.
The natural way.
Yep.
Is that right?
Absolutely. Yep. September 2014, I remember the day that we decided, my husband Brad and I, and we naively thought, a couple months, it's going to be easy peasy. We had a lot of friends who were pregnant at the time. And then each month that went on was more and more stressful and more is this normal? What's happening? Am I overreacting? Am I being dramatic? Or is this something that I need to be listening to? And is this something that we need to be getting checked out? And even that dialogue between my husband and I, it took us about a year and a half to even feel comfortable going in and getting tests and getting those answers, because you want to know because you want to solve it. But also when you know, there's no turning back. So it's also a big reality check.
This is what Linda was saying about the ambiguity of it, too. That's uncomfortable, but it's also not a final decision.
Right.
Right.
And the other part is that it's not only just an identity thing for the individuals, but it is for the couples.
Absolutely.
Many couples marry because they envision, this is the person that's I'm going to raise my children with. And it's if that doesn't happen, they then question, well, what's this marriage for? Why am I in this marriage? Do I want to be in this marriage? And I've had couples where one partner will say, yeah, if this isn't going to work, I'm not going to be in this marriage.
So, Elizabeth, how do you detect that in the couples as a physician, in the couples that you're working with? I mean, how do you confront that?
Well, I think that it's a big part of what you do. I mean, you can do the tests and say this is an abnormal sperm count or you're not ovulating. But I think if you leave it at that and then don't go further and deal with the ramifications, it's important. Sometimes within the couple, somebody feels it's their fault. Mm-hmm. You know, then they can go down multiple different roads, including, you know, would you have married me, or would we be a couple if you had known this from the beginning? Sometimes you can't find any issue, and that's probably the most frustrating of all, when you tell couples you have a diagnosis of unexplained infertility. All your testing is normal and we don't know why. It may get better with time, but there are some things that can speed it up. It's really a complicated dynamic, because it's not just one person, it's two people. It may be one problem, zero problems, two identifiable problems. And there are multiple different pathways to try to get to an answer. It's not like a certain kind of cancer where everybody agrees you should go to this chemotherapy first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Lise, what Elizabeth just said about you and your husband both bringing your expectations and your sense of who you are. And there will be differences somewhere in the middle of that, too. And having to work that out while you're also facing, you know, all of the uncertainty of this, right?
Yeah. Well, totally. And your feelings about it change. It's not just, oh, I want to have kids no matter what, necessarily. Sometimes you get there and that's how you feel. But every day and the more information you get about your medical case, the more it can change your opinion. So at the very beginning of our process, my husband, Brad, was very much in, I don't want to do IVF. It's off the table. I'm not interested in pursuing that.
Why?
I think he wasn't ready to let go of that. You know, we want to conceive our baby in our own bed and, you know, look at the pregnancy test. And of course, everybody wants that. But I don't think he was necessarily ready to let go of that dream. And then when I got my diagnosis a year and a half into trying of endometriosis, and we realized that our odds were pretty low of conceiving naturally, all of a sudden he was really on board the IVF train when we started talking about odds. And all of a sudden, oh, our odds of conceiving with IVF are going to be substantially better than trying on our own. And all of a sudden his tune changed. And then with that first round of IVF, he was very much of the opinion, I only want to do one round of IVF. And then when our first round of IVF failed, it was, maybe we could do another round. So that line really moves a lot. So it's an ongoing conversation with your partner, and it's, you have to check in all the time to make sure you guys are on the same page, and just still aligned.
Because I often caution couples that they can walk into an infertility clinic and sign a blank check of their time, their emotional stability, and their money.
Well, that sounds pretty intimidating.
It is. And I usually tell them when they're, you know, at their lowest point, to say, this is sort of what's happened. And now we've got to regroup, because no one can sign a blank check. You know,
and I like your point talking about partners. It's not always a husband and wife. It can be unmarried partners. It can be two women. It can be two men. It can be a single individual that says, I'm committed to, you know, being a single parent and have this obstacle. So
is it sometimes easier if it's an individual when you're going through this? I just think trying to work out a lot of the couple dynamics.
It can be. I think, you know, again, there are some couples that are absolutely on the same page, and there are other couples where they're not even in the same room, and working to a joint decision is difficult. But I think as a single person pursuing fertility, there are other obstacles. There's, less flexibility in making appointments. There's maybe work. Not family support or work support.
Right.
So that each situation has its unique challenges.
Linda, you were going to say?
Yeah, I was just going to piggyback on that social support is so very important to people when they have a medical diagnosis. Look at cancer, breast cancer, you know, the runs, the ribbons, the pins, you know, it's like community is holding people up and saying, we support you because you're going through this. Most of the time infertile couples, sort of like Elise, their friends are going on with their lives in a way that's leaving them behind. And that's isolating, really isolating.
What was that like, Elise?
That was honestly one of the hardest parts, was watching my friendships and my relationships change. I've lost friends over infertility who didn't necessarily know how to be there for me. And I struggled with finding a way to show up for them. And I mean, the baby showers and the first birthdays and each milestone that goes by. And it's been another year of trying and another year of right back where you are, it can be really hard. And so finding people who understand what you're going through or can be there for you in a meaningful way can make all the difference.
Did it get to the point where it was hard, I mean, a year and a half or 2 years into this, where it was hard to tell people where you were at on this?
I think for me, it actually got easier the longer we went on and the more information we had and the more I understood the diagnosis, and the more Brad and I were aligned with our path, it felt easier to talk about. But it also depends on who you're talking to about it. Some people are really empathetic and great and compassionate and send you cards and are really present and find a way to show up. And some people feel really awkward and just kind of vanish. So I think it can really help differentiate between who's there for you really and who is just there when it's all fun and games.
You know, what's interesting about that is that's not all that different than you hear people talk about grieving any kind of loss, right? Or a diagnosis of some kind.
And that phenomenon can happen not just with friends, but with family. Family members can disappear.
Well, family members can be insensitive. You can be going to Thanksgiving dinner and, you know, your mother-in-law says, well, when are you going to give me a grandchild? And you've been struggling with this issue, and it can be emotionally devastating. Holidays are really hard times for infertility couples.
When we told my grandma, who's 90 years old, that, you know, we had been trying for a couple years, it was at Thanksgiving. And I will never forget, she was like, well, I wish I had that problem. She had 5 kids within 8 years. And I was like, cool reaction. Thanks.
You're listening to a Friday Roundtable. It's a conversation about fertility, where the procedures are, where the innovation is. What about the emotional support? What happens with individuals or couples who are going through this? Elise Ash is with us. She's the founder of Fruitful, and it's a nonprofit fertility mentorship project. And we'll talk a little bit about how it works. Linda Hammer Burns is here, a licensed psychologist and associate professor at the University of Minnesota Medical School. And Dr. Elizabeth Stewart is the chair of the Division of Reproductive Endocrinology and Infertility at the Mayo Clinic. Elizabeth, one of the things I wanted to ask you about is how the pursuit of a pregnancy draws a couple or an individual deeper and deeper into more experimental procedures, and how aware they are and how aware the medical community has to make them that they are getting deeper and deeper into experimental procedures. How do you approach that?
Well, I think that there is a good deal of evidence for most infertility care that it is effective. Many of the drugs we've had have been around for decades. In vitro fertilization has been available since the 1970s. And in fact, the inventors of that were awarded the Nobel Prize for their scientific achievement. So I think we're living in an era where science can help more couples than had previously. But I think you have to know what's happening. You have to be comfortable with moving in that direction. Some couples don't feel that using medication or procedures such as IVF are something they're comfortable with. Some people have religious concerns. Some people have ethical concerns. And I think being willing to talk about those issues and open up that conversation is an important part of what I do.
Well, I asked you about this because I was reading about this procedure that's being done in Canada where it's called it's like an egg refresher procedure. Have you read about this?
Yeah. So there are a couple of experimental infertility procedures that are being done worldwide. In fact, just last week, there was a report of gene editing that was done. So I think that the consensus within the infertility community are these things are experimental. They're not being done routinely, and they should only be done under strict research guidelines. So I think that if you come in and say, I want infertility care today, you're not likely to be offered those in the United States.
Right. I think that's the same with uterine transplants. That was there was a conference about that a couple of years ago. And the man, he was Australian, who was the leader of this very big study, really said to the whole conference of American Society of Reproductive Medicine, yes, this is a breakthrough. We did successfully get 10 pregnancies from donated uteruses, using donated uteruses. But he said, you know, this is not ready for prime time. This is still experimental, and it will be for at least 10 years. I think what happens is people read the headlines and think, okay, that's the thing that I need. You know, I know I'm carrying this bad gene, and that's what's causing my infertility. Maybe it's a mild form of cystic fibrosis that's causing blocked vas deferens and male factor infertility. And they think, well, we can fix that. Well, actually, a lot of it is not ready for prime time. But the other ones that couples stumble on are the ones that involve third-party reproduction. That means using donor sperm, donor egg, gestational carriers.
How experimental is that? I mean, there's been a lot of that going on,
at all.
Right?
I mean, donor sperm has been around since 1884.
Okay.
and I think it was 1984 when we started donor egg, somewhere in the same neighborhood 100 years later. What was different about it was that in 1884, no one told anyone, and it was kept secret.
I see.
And the woman who was inseminated with someone else's sperm was not even told that it had happened. Now, when we started with donor egg, in the beginning, it was almost always an identified donation. It was a sister, a cousin, a good friend. Now there is, I think we might call it a commercialization with donor egg, and that can lead to more expense, but also more dilemmas and problems.
Yeah, you looked a little concerned about the commercialization idea. Elizabeth, how does that strike you?
Well, I think it is a reasonable term to use, that there are commercial enterprises that help couples. Again, you can be in a situation where you don't have eggs and you don't have a sister,
right.
You don't have a cousin, you know, you don't have a best friend that can provide this service to you. Again, we've had women where they had severe medical problems, so they couldn't carry their pregnancy, and their mothers have been able to carry their pregnancy for them. But some families don't have that backup. So I think that there are newer options. They're not for everyone, and nobody should ever be pressured into going in that direction. There are many ways to build a family, and donor egg or gestational carrier is the right answer for some couples. Adoption is the right answer for other couples. Child-free living is another option. So I think it's not a one-size-fits-all proposition.
Yeah. Another option, too, is embryo adoption, which is I have a couple of friends who've done that.
Yeah.
It's essentially when a couple goes through the IVF process and they have leftover embryos after they're done completing their family that are still frozen. And so what do? They just sit there either in the frozen forever. Mm-hmm. You can either donate them to science, you can decide to discard them, or you can put them up for adoption. So a couple who might not be able to afford IVF all the way at the start, which is really expensive, something else we haven't really talked about yet. But it's a good, affordable option for a lot of couples who want to still experience pregnancy, but aren't as concerned with the biology of their child being genetically related to them.
So earlier, Elise, you said that your husband, Brad, was initially, I don't want to do IVF, and then we'll do one round, and then we'll do two rounds. And then what happened as the second round didn't work either? What was the conversation like between
you
two?
Well, we're kind of still in the middle of our story right now. So the second IVF procedure was a lot more successful. So right now we're kind of waiting for a good time to start transferring some of the embryos that we got. So it hasn't failed yet. So
okay.
We're still in the middle of that process, but we definitely have backup plans on backup plans. I mean, we've talked about, would we do IVF again? Or, you know, at that point, would we consider adoption, which is something we've talked a lot about. And also our opinion has changed as we've gone longer and longer. But again, like I said earlier, it's constantly changing.
And why do you think that is?
I think your reality changes. So originally you think, oh, you know, I want 2.5 kids and I'm going to have one girl first, then I'm going to have a boy, and then I'm going to have a June baby because that's exactly when I want my baby. And then all of a sudden when things start to not go the way that you expect them to go, your expectations loosen. And then all of a sudden you're open to more ideas and you realize that you might not necessarily care about genetics. You know, I know that's not important to me. I grew up a camp counselor around kids all the time, and I know how easy it is to love a child who isn't necessarily biologically related to you. So to me, that wasn't ever an issue. But to my husband, who isn't necessarily like a kid person, that was something that was harder for him to see until now, a few years later. So it's just constantly changing.
Well, and Elise brings up an important point about costs, is that in most countries, insurance pays for IVF. And here many people are paying for it out of pocket. Even people who have employer-based health care don't necessarily get coverage.
Well, give me a sense of what it costs.
Well, in general, the cost of an IVF cycle is probably a minimum of $10,000 between medications, procedures, in most of the country. And so I think that, you know, that also leads you to potentially make choices that are not good. You know, again, you've put all this money in, you lean in the direction of transferring two embryos, which increases your pregnancy rate just a little bit, but phenomenally increases your chance of twins. And with twins, there are multiple medical implications for the babies and for moms. So a different situation if, again, infertility is treated like a disease and is covered in an appropriate fashion by insurance.
Linda, what about the kind of in for a penny, in for a pound approach? This sounds so natural. We've done all this already.
Right.
We've already spent this much money.
Right.
We're not going to stop now.
Right. I've seen couples who are that way. And I think those are the couples that are economically better off. People who have average jobs, teachers, they will borrow money, mortgage money. I've had families help out and in big ways. And when it fails, then it's even worse because you feel like you failed your parents that you were hoping to make grandparents. Yes, they lend you the money. And it's out of their retirement funds. And all of those different dilemmas, it really sort of piles on the sense of guilt that you've not done anything, you've done something wrong and it's not right. But there's another part we're not doing, and that is educating our young people about their reproductive health. You know, obesity is a problem in this country. It affects fertility. Use of drugs, alcohol, this affects fertility in both men and women. We don't talk about that.
I have a couple questions about that. Is age more of a factor in fertility than some of the other, than weight and some of the other?
Age is the primary infertility factor, at least for women. For men, it does kick in, but usually later. But
so, Elizabeth, tell me so these are just a couple of numbers I thought that would be interesting for context. When a woman reaches 32, is her chance of conceiving starting to decrease at a pretty rapid rate. Is that about the transitionary age?
Well, fertility declines with increasing age, even through your 20s. But it's usually not a sharp decline till sometime in the mid-30s. I wouldn't pick the age 32.
Okay.
For some women, it is 32. For some women, it's 35. For some women, it's 38. But there becomes a period of time, sometime for most women in their mid-30s, where you get a rapid decline in your fertility because women have all of the eggs they're ever going to have before they're born. And so men make new sperm at every point in their reproductive life. But women have a really time-limited resource.
What happens by the time you hit 40? Are your chances really declining of conceiving naturally,
For most women, yes.
Okay.
Again, there is a spectrum so that there are women who start trying for pregnancy at 40. But in general, if you look at any kind of fertility statistics, the rates are better the younger you are going into treatment.
And then the age in women, as well as older men, you increase risk of anomalies in the child that are age-related.
Mm-hmm. When you said, Linda, that we don't educate about obesity and medication use and all of that, where's the appropriate place for that?
I don't know. I personally, my belief is health class. When
really?
You're talking okay. about sexuality and protecting yourself and, know what your body does. We should be telling young people, as girls, you're born with the number of eggs you're going to have in a lifetime.
Yeah, I didn't know that till I was an adult.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Protect yourself against sexually transmitted diseases because that's going to affect your fertility.
Mm-hmm.
That they should be doing what they can to keep themselves healthy if they think at some point in the future they want to have children.
Did you know any of that, Elise?
No. You're basically just taught don't.
Yeah,
have sex.
That's right.
And you won't get pregnant.
There's a lot of the warning.
No.
That's right. About watch out or you're going to get pregnant.
And that's
right?
Part of what's so overwhelming at the beginning of the process, too, is you're basically learning biology as you go. And you're learning, the average woman releases one egg per cycle. I didn't even know that going into it as opposed to, and then when you're on the IVF medications and all of a sudden you're making many more eggs. Well, follicles, what's the difference between a follicle and an egg? There's all these different questions that all of a sudden you're faced with, and the stakes are so high. It's really expensive. You don't know what's necessarily right for you in your specific situation. So it's really overwhelming. There are a ton of acronyms and long words that are hard to Google, and it's really an overwhelming process from a medical standpoint. And when you don't have that information or context, you're starting at ground zero.
I'm curious about how you and your husband talked about the expense of this, too.
Yeah, that was a big conversation because we also decided we actually skipped a couple steps along the way. We went from doing Clomid, which is a fairly affordable option,
which is
really
a medication.
Just a pill. Yeah, it's kind of like the first thing you get prescribed when they don't really know what's wrong or why it's taking you a while. So we went from that, and then we actually skipped IUIs, which are intrauterine insemination, and those are kind of fancy turkey-baster method where you're still on the medication to ovulate and then they inseminate you with your husband's sperm. But We skipped that step because I was having problems releasing eggs and ovulating. So for our specific situation, it didn't make a lot of sense to invest the time and money, and we were all out of pocket. So, An IUI is $1,500, but IVF is $15,000. But if we know that there's a low chance of the IUIs working, then that for us seemed like a waste of money, but it's different for everyone.
Right,
so,
But for you yourself, you went right to
we did because
the IVF and the expense of that.
Yeah. And I talked about earlier the odds, and it really is like gambling. We talked a little bit about you put money in and, what's the best, what are the highest odds for this investment? And so for us, it made sense to take that risk financially. The second round of IVF, we were lucky to have some family help, and similar to what we were talking about earlier, I've also seen a lot of couples decide to go the crowdfunding route right now or do some kind of fundraiser to help raise the funds, because it is so prohibitive and people want to help and, you know, people want to chip in 20, 50 bucks and make your dream come true. But it, like we talked about earlier, that's also there's added pressure there.
You're listening to the Friday Roundtable. We're talking about fertility, the science of it, the emotional context of it. And our roundtablers today, Dr. Elizabeth Stewart up with us from Mayo, Linda Hammer-Burns with us from the University of Minnesota Medical School, and Elise Ash, the founder of Fruitful, which we're going to talk about on the other side of news. It's a nonprofit fertility mentorship project. So we'll get a look at the latest news and we'll continue our conversation.
Good morning. I'm Phil Picardi in the NPR newsroom. Beyond the bluster, the U.S. has been quietly engaged in back-channel diplomacy with North Korea for several months. The Associated Press has learned the U.S. has used the channel to try to address the fate of Americans imprisoned in the communist country and deteriorating relations between the longtime foes. People familiar with the diplomacy say that while the contacts have not quelled tensions, they are leaving the door open to more serious negotiations. President Trump has issued an urgent warning to North Korea not to move ahead with its ballistic missile testing. He tweeted this morning, "Military solutions are now fully in place, locked and loaded. Should North Korea act unwisely, hopefully Kim Jong-un will find another path." President Trump is suggesting Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell might have to think about stepping aside if he doesn't deliver on the president's agenda of health care, taxes, and infrastructure. The president called McConnell's failure to repeal Obamacare a disgrace. A U.S. Marine who served in the Pacific during World War II is traveling to a remote Japanese village to return a flag he took from the body of a dead enemy soldier 73 years ago. An Oregon-based group was able to identify the soldier and find his village through signatures left on the flag by relatives and neighbors. Marvin Strombo is now 93 years old and says returning the flag to the man's surviving siblings will help with healing. And a train collision near Egypt's coastal city of Alexandria today killed at least 28 people and injured 80 others. The two trains collided head-on. There was no immediate information on what caused the collision, and the officials say the death toll and the number of injured could rise. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 10:38.
Increase the impact of your sustaining membership by switching to an automatic deduction through your checking account. It eliminates credit card fees so more of your gift can power the radio you love. Switch today at npr.org/checking.
I'm Tom Weber. Stay with NPR News at 11 o'clock. Andrea Swenson from The Current and I will have our next interview in the Summer Music Series. We're visiting with Gretchen Sechrist of The Lonesome Kid. She's making her first performance since she was sidelined by Lyme disease. You'll hear all about that at 11.
Programming is supported by The Guthrie, now playing Native Gardens, a comedy about new neighbors whose delicate disagreement over a fence line turns into an all-out border dispute. Now through August 26, tickets and more information at GuthrieTheater.org.
You're listening to the Friday Roundtable, and it's a roundtable about reproduction and fertility. Three guests on the roundtable. And I'm asking you, if you're using fertility procedures to have children, what do you know now that you wished you'd understood at the beginning? Have you gotten the kind of emotional support that you felt like you needed through this process? You can tweet me on this. It's at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Elise, I'm going to turn to you and ask you what I'm asking listeners about. What do you wish you, what do you know now that you wish you'd known at the beginning?
So much. I guess I wish I knew how, what my options were. There was no clear definitive source for if you're going through this, here's what you should do first, then second, then third, then fourth. It's different for everyone. So it's really, I guess I wish I knew more about the biology at the beginning so I could have been more informed. And I wish I also had better expectations around IVF. I think our first round that had failed was an incredible loss for me because I really thought it was a sure thing. Naively, I thought, oh, IVF, you know, we're paying $15,000 for this thing and then we'll get our baby. Great. And then when it didn't work out that way, I don't think I was really emotionally prepared to deal with that fallout. So I think in general, I wish I had had better expectations around the entire process.
Elizabeth, I think this goes to what you wanted to say about online resources, right? Helping to manage some expectations there. So what's out there?
Well, so there are a number of sites. So again, many clinics have sites. So Mayo Clinic has information. The American Society for Reproductive Medicine has good resources. There's an infertility advocacy and information group called Resolve that has good online resources. But a new one is the Society of Assisted Reproductive Technology, or SART, has a pregnancy calculator. And so they've taken nationwide IVF data in the United States and been able to give you what your average pregnancy rate is and be able to put in your age, your height, your weight, your diagnosis, and your prior pregnancy history, and give you some sense of what your pregnancy rate is after one cycle, two cycles.
Just from that?
Cycles.
Just from...
Well, again, it's an average. So okay. Again, some programs, it may be a little bit higher, some it'll be lower, but it will get you in the ballpark. If it tells you your pregnancy rate is 5%, then there's no program in the country that's going to get you a 95% pregnancy rate.
And so don't let anyone sell you that. But that, keep in mind that this SART data has been collected for what, 20 years? 25 years,
but the I think the data is on more recent information, but, so it's been within the last couple of years,
right? And not only is there the SART data, but we have the SART, the same assisted reproductive technology data from WHO, so patients can get this information, and it really is helpful in educating them and helping them sort through this, you know, overwhelming amount of information.
What you said a minute ago, though, I don't want to leave on the table. When you said don't let anybody sell you that, if your percentage is going to be fairly low, educate yourself about that. And I mean, what do you need to be aware of out there in the fertility industry?
Well, I think there's some as you mentioned, the doctor in Canada. Mm-hmm.
The egg refresher procedure?
Every once in a while, there seems to be some little thing that comes up that everyone thinks this is the best. I had a patient who told me there's someone doing neuropathology sessions to increase fertility. So this is in the mental health field, just as much as it is the medical field.
Right.
And I know she went to 6 months of that, and I'm like, what did it involve? She goes, I'm not really sure.
And, but she did it for 6 months and incurred whatever expense that cost.
Right.
Wow.
And I said, well, was it helpful? I'm not really sure. I mean, she couldn't define what happened or what was good about it or anything.
Right.
So I think there are people out there who, I'm not saying they're not, you know, I don't want to be critical because of someone coming up with a new idea that might be helpful. But here's another way in which you need to be educated and why websites like Elise's and the ones that Elizabeth has mentioned are really, really important.
So Elise, this is a good place to talk about what Fruitful does. How'd you start it?
So my husband Brad and I created Fruitful last year. We launched early this April 2017. And the whole idea behind Fruitful is that it's really hard for people who haven't been through infertility firsthand to understand the emotional, financial stress that comes with all of this. There's so much information to learn. It can be incredibly overwhelming. So the whole idea came from the fact that people who've been through it before are really great allies and people who have a lot of information. And especially now that once they're on the other side of their infertility story, they really have that perspective and can offer the emotional support and empathy that a lot of people who haven't been through it can't. So what Fruitful does is it's a platform where people can sign up if they're experiencing infertility and they can be matched with a fertility mentor. So someone who's been through it firsthand. I do all the matching myself based on profiles that people fill out with their age, where they live, their medical diagnosis. You know, are they religious? Are they into nutrition? What's their story? And then I match people on the back end and they can connect and really form that relationship and help get that emotional support.
So are the mentors that you're matching always people who have succeeded in the fertility quest? Or are there some people in there that say, we tried this for 3 years and then we went on with our lives as different as we thought they'd be?
Everybody has a different end to their fertility story. So whether that means that IVF was successful for them, they decided to pursue donor egg or sperm donor or embryo adoption or traditional adoption, foster to adopt, or just decided, you know what, we've spent a lot of money and we just want to enjoy our life and travel and have fun together. We're looking for mentors who have all of those experiences to offer the best support.
Do you have a mentor?
I have some non-official mentors, but I've been lucky to meet a lot of really strong women, especially here in Minneapolis.
I'll bet.
Who are warriors in an incredible way. And they've been incredibly helpful while I try to navigate my own feelings.
So, Linda, earlier you mentioned the mental health implications of this.
Right.
And I mean, in some ways, what Elise is doing with Fruitful is getting at some of that.
Exactly. And in a great way, because we know social support really, really, really is a good remedy for people. I think we haven't, you've described it, but I want to name it. And that is that the IVF process, no matter what the infertility diagnosis is, 90% of it, if you do IVF, if it's a male factor cause of the infertility, they're still going to do IVF to treat it, which means the woman gets the lion's share of the medical treatment,
Okay. While
the man does not. And that can create not only some resentment, but it's a big burden to be keeping track of all these meds and these appointments and all of that. And husband steps in and goes, well, I thought we could go on vacation this weekend. And she's like, what are you talking about?
Right.
I'm having a retrieval on Friday. So that sort of disconnect, and it's hard for them to stay in step together. But I think the other very real reality, and this again is based on research, is that this experience of infertility, including miscarriages, chemical pregnancies after IVF, late pregnancy losses, difficult pregnancies, mm-hmm. can trigger a first time ever mental health problem. So someone who's never had a mental health problem can develop very severe depression, disabling anxiety, or it can recur a problem that they had earlier in their life. Maybe an eating disorder, maybe an episode of depression with a breakup during college.
The stress of this can bring up
exactly.
Previous.
Right.
As I'm listening to Linda, Elizabeth, I'm thinking about how you guide couples who might be a ways into this and haven't had the success that they want, and how you have a conversation with couples or individuals or whoever about when it's time to stop or how to wait for a while or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, you're giving them really disappointing news.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the hardest part of what I do. And I think the mindset once you get in there is to keep going. So even if you say, do you want to take a break? Maybe you need to take a little bit of time here. That people find that difficult. And
well, what do you say about that when you sense resistance to the recommendation?
Well, again, that you have to work with a couple. You know, it's very hard to say, no, I'm not going to provide care for you. You need a break. I think it has to be a dialogue. And I think Linda's point is that most of the burden does fall on the woman, but sometimes the ability to talk about things and find a mentor or find someone they can speak to is even more difficult for the partner. It's
right.
Often, if you're sitting there discussing a pregnancy loss, you know, the woman will often have tears and be able to connect with her feelings. And you can tell that her partner is feeling the same thing, but he doesn't have a way to express it.
And he feels he can't. He really shouldn't, because it'll burden her more, not realizing that shared grief is better. I mean, the other part is that it's hard, I think, for patients to hear that, you know, if you don't take a break, you're distressed. You're clearly distressed to the point where you're not sleeping well, all the symptoms of depression or anxiety. What the research shows is that when people have that going on, it reduces the success rates.
Yeah.
So
this is such an impossible situation
right.
to be in, right? You're going
right.
to feel stressed,
right?
But you really don't want to be stressed because then that's going to inhibit your fertility.
And everyone tells you, don't be stressed, just relax, go on vacation and it'll happen. Really? Note to listeners, do not say that to your friends who are struggling with infertility.
Elise, what else do you not say to people about this?
I think in general, with any kind of diagnosis or loss, you really just want to be there for them and say, I'm here to listen. You know, what can I do to be there for you? How can I support you? Rather than giving advice. Because chances are, if you say, oh, my friend got pregnant through acupuncture, or my other friend is trying this gluten-free diet, have you tried not eating gluten? Like, those are all things we all know. We've looked it up. We've seen the research. We spend a lot of time Googling us infertile folk. And we've tried it all. We've seen it all. And so while it might feel like you're helping, it's really actually putting more stress on your friend. So in general, I would say just let them feel comfortable talking about it. Tell them that you're there for them. Those are really the best things you can do, rather than try to give advice or tell them stories about, oh, my coworker at work, the second they stopped trying, that's when they got pregnant. Like, those kinds of stories are really hard to hear.
You know, I'm struck by that phrase, and I know you were kind of kidding. You said, us infertile folk, we spend a lot of time on Google. But is that how you've begun to think of yourself? Or?
Yeah, definitely. I think there are definitely more positive ways to spin it. There are ways, fertility warriors, they're kind of different, more positive.
What is a
phrases.
Fertility warrior? Because you've said that a couple times. What
yeah,
is it?
It's someone who has been through the ringer with all of this and has been beaten down and gone through it, but has come out stronger and on the other side. And whether that means they're taking a break, or they're still in the process of treatments, or they're, you know, they've had quote unquote success. There's someone who knows what it feels like and has been there. And usually it's, I think the technical infertility diagnosis, correct me if I'm wrong, Elizabeth, is someone who's been trying over a year to achieve a pregnancy.
Yeah, a year if you're 35 or younger, or 6 months if you're older, have other factors.
So that's technically, I guess.
You are diagnosed as infertile if you've been trying for a year and you're under 35 years old.
Right. With regular sexual intercourse.
Yes.
Huh. Yeah.
The other thing I'd like to say is that when patients do get sent to counseling, so doctors say, you know, I really think this would be a good time. Maybe the reason for the referral is for education about a specific kind of treatment, mm-hmm. or maybe it is for mental health reasons. But patients often come in telling me, yeah, I've been sent here because something's wrong with me. And right there, you know, not starting on a great place. And I think there should be, I mean, this is about our whole attitude about mental health care in general, that, you know, if you see a shrink, then there's something really wrong. And what we're really trying to do is help them manage the stress, give them new tools. What the research shows is that infertile couples, after 3 to 5 years of infertility treatment, reach an apex of stress.
I'll bet.
And it's comparable to 3 years of cancer treatment.
Wow.
So that what happens is what we psychologists would like is for people to have a smorgasbord of coping techniques that are all equally effective. But by the time they reach that apex, they have one or two maybe that are still using, but they are not as effective due to overuse.
Right.
So what we often try to do is build back these ways of coping, pull them back, add them in, make a plan for actually doing an activity that you know is helpful for you during that IVF cycle as a couple and as individuals.
That's great.
And to look at this as more of a more adjunctive therapy.
Right.
So
we anticipate being real intentional about anticipating that this is going to be stressful.
Right.
Elizabeth, what is your best advice for couples who are in the midst of this?
I think the advice I would give is, first of all, educate yourself and be an advocate for yourself.
And what does that mean?
It can mean a number of things. It means asking questions. It means saying, is this the only option I have? How much does this cost? What are my other options? Again, it's not a one-size-fits-all treatment. And I think one of the things that's really important is that it's important for us as providers to say, you know, this is not an effective treatment. Again, I think many...
You mean to be able to say to the couple, we've tried this, it's not working.
Or there's no
or
research
that there's
on
no,
that.
There's no, yeah. there's
oh,
no reason to go in this direction.
Okay.
Again, our guidelines suggest that there are certain things we shouldn't ethically be doing if we don't think we're going to get this couple to at least a pregnancy rate of 5%, it shouldn't be done. And, you know, many programs don't have ineffective care guidelines where they say if these numbers are so poor that you're really not going in the direction of a good pregnancy rate, we shouldn't be doing this. And that, I think that's the most difficult conversation to have.
Elisa, that's probably something that mentors can help with, but I wonder if you and your husband have had that discussion yet. So how far are we willing now that you're into the middle of this?
Yeah, we've definitely had that conversation of how far are we willing to go. And, you know, we're definitely not of the mindset of, you know, kids no matter what. Some people feel that way. Some people don't. And after 3 years of this, I think you realize the emotional and financial toll it takes.
Yeah.
And eventually you're just like, is this over yet? Like, I don't know.
I just want to go back to living the
kind
life.
Kind of.
Right?
Yeah, it'd be nice to go back to a time where we could just, you know, enjoy everything and live in that optimism. So you do have to keep checking back in with each other to make sure you're on the same page. But I think for us right now, we're in a good place. We feel optimistic, but we're also not a kids no matter what kind of couple right now.
How do you become a mentor for Fruitful?
You can sign up on the website, so fruitfulfertility.org. So you can sign up either to be a mentor or to receive a mentor. And yeah, it's a really great resource for people who are looking for someone to confide in privately who knows exactly what they're going through.
I really love the idea of you matchmaking kind of behind the scenes because that's how I thought of it.
I agree.
It's neat.
Pretty much exactly how it is. I'm the only one who sees any of the information. It's all private, back end, super secure. So all of that information is just with me, and I only use it to match you with someone who I think is going to be awesome.
I'm really glad you're here, and good luck.
Thanks.
Good to have you here. Linda, thank you so much. Elizabeth, thanks for coming up from Mayo.
My pleasure.
Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Thank you.